Much-needed moisture gives firefighters a welcome break. Good evening, I'm Courtney Anderson.
And I'm Sarah Jovetic, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
Capitol reporter Dan Boyce takes us on a tour of a major hydroelectric project now operating near Great Falls. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the co-founders of a project to help educate people about those who are born with ambiguous gender traits. No one welcomes the rain that's been falling in much of western Montana today more than the firefighters. A spokeswoman for the Firestone Flats fire burning near Arleigh says the rain has been very helpful at keeping that fire at 1,750 acres. She says firefighters spent part of today bringing heavy equipment down off the fire in anticipation of more rain that could make roads too muddy for travel. Beckman also says fire managers are evaluating whether to release some of the firefighters from that fire that is now 75% contained. Meanwhile, the 3,400-acre Moose Meadow fire near Phillipsburg is now 20% contained.
And in other news from around the state, Missoula's police chief is turning over the handling of daily operations to his assistant chief so he can focus on the city's response to a U.S. Department of Justice investigation over police response to reports of rape and sexual violence. Police Chief Mark Muir tells the Missoulian that progress is already being made. He says officers are already more sensitive to, quote, how their efforts to investigate are perceived by victims, unquote, and do a better job of explaining why they're asking such sensitive questions. Muir says training sessions are scheduled next week and in September, and a panel of professionals will review closed cases to determine if any more changes in policies or procedures are needed. He says he hopes to have much of the work done before he retires in December.
PPL Montana is now operating a completely renovated Rainbow Dam just a few miles northeast of Great Falls. The $230 million project marks the biggest investment in energy generation in the state since the Colstrip coal-fired power plant was built about 30 years ago. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce takes us on a tour of the dam and tells us what its new technology can do.
An enormous steel cylinder is spinning inside a new concrete building right next to the Missouri River. That cylinder is generating a lot of power.
It almost doubles the output of this plant in terms of electricity.
That's PPL Montana Director of External Affairs David Hoffman. It's enough to power about 45,000 homes. Construction on this renovation started back in 2009. The new dam went fully online this past April. Operations foreman Jerry Gray says the basic idea has not changed much.
The same electromagnetic induction to create the electricity is the windings and everything are essentially the same as they were 100 years ago.
You take water from a high place, you pour it down to a lower place, spinning some kind of wheel to make power. Humans have been doing that for generations. Greatly refined now, though. Rainbow Dam was built above a set of natural waterfalls.
And then you put a conveyance system, some way to get the water from the dam downstream. You take advantage of the natural drop in the terrain.
The key is, you want the water to drop as far as possible to put the most force against the power-generating turbine. Water flowing into the dam starts about 30 feet above the riverbed, but it then runs into this concrete channel that takes it a half mile downstream. Over the course of that half mile, the lay of the land drops more and more. When it reaches the end, the water funnels into a pipe and drops 112 feet down into the turbine, spinning that metal cylinder, creating power. But although it's spinning at a pretty good clip, it's a lot slower than it used to be. The old Rainbow Dam had eight smaller twin turbines that were a lot faster. Any fish that happened to swim through those was a goner. External Affairs Director David Hoffman says those eight twin turbines have been completely replaced by the new single turbine.
Estimated to be about 95% less fish mortality for fish that may pass through that.
PPL predicts the new power station and turbine at Rainbow Dam should be able to last as long as the old system did, about 100 years. I'm Dan Boyce reporting outside Great Falls.
The University of Montana has received a $1 million grant to endow a program that provides scholarships for non-traditional students. There are 90 Osher Reentry Scholarship programs across the United States. UM has the only such program in Montana. The San Francisco-based Bernard Osher Foundation initially gave UM $50,000 in 2010 to start a program for re-entry students or non-traditional students who want to go back to school. The UM Foundation's Beth Hammack says people who obtain their degrees earn better wages, which in turn is good for the state's overall economy. Hammack says 40 UM students have received $2,500 scholarships through the Osher Foundation.
$2,500 is about half the cost of tuition at the University of Montana, so they're really getting a great start and being able to afford to pay what it costs to attend the university. And then they are also eligible for other financial aid. So a lot of times all of their tuition is paid, and then, of course, you still have to pay for your housing and books and all those sorts of things. And when you're going to school full-time, that can be a challenge. So this helps a lot. It might mean the difference between somebody having to work 40 hours a week or work 20 hours a week to be able to go to school. And I have talked with people who work 40 hours a week and carry a full load of classes, and that's just really hard. So it's really helping people have a better life while they're college students.
Osher reentry scholar Patrick Wayne returned to UM at the age of 47. Wayne plans to graduate this fall with a Bachelor of Arts in Political Science with an emphasis in public administration. He's now thinking about pursuing his master's degree.
It really helps a lot, and anything you can get in these entities that come into the picture to make it easier for students of all ages, it's a real help. And I think society in general needs all the help they can get educating as many people as they can.
Eligible Osher reentry scholars are students with a cumulative gap in their education of 5 or more years, are at the undergraduate level and pursuing their first baccalaureate degree, are ideally 25 to 50 years old, have demonstrated a financial need, and show economic promise and a commitment to obtaining their degree. Applications will be accepted this fall. For more information, contact the University of Montana's Financial Aid Office.
Weed-sniffing dogs are being used as part of the state's fight on noxious invasive plants. Dogs and their trainers from Missoula-based Working Dogs for Conservation are being drafted for various conservation-related services across the country and the world. Flathead reporter Katrin Fry has more from a mountainside, where a dog named Lily scans the tall grass for Dyer's woad.
Lily is one of two dogs from the Missoula-based Working Dogs for Conservation, trained to sniff out Dyer's woad.
She's a 5-year-old yellow lab. She's from a shelter in Georgia, and she's been with us for 3 years. And this is the fifth scent she knows.
Director Amy Hurt with the nonprofit organization says Lily also knows another weed, Chinese bush clover.
And then she knows some scat, grizzly bear, black bear, and cross river gorilla scat.
Like the Chinese bush clover, cross river gorilla scat is not something Lily will come across as she sniffs out Dyer's woad near Tally Lake, northwest of Kalispell. Lily works with canine field specialist Nio Richards, searching through the tall grass for the leafy plant, which is part of the mustard family. And statewide coordinator Amber Birch with the Montana Cooperative Dyer's Woad Project says came to the U.S. from Russia and Asia.
And so it was brought over. It produces a blue dye or indigo dye. So the plant was brought over to be cultivated for the production of that dye. Since then, there's industrial dyes that have replaced that quality of the plant.
Birch says the problem with Dyer's Woad is typical of other invasive weeds.
The biggest problem with it, it just has the ability to spread very quickly and take over areas, displace native vegetation, rapid seed growth.
Birch says Montana's Cooperative Dyer's Woad Project started in the 1980s, and they had identified 17 patches. Now they're down to 6, and they count fewer than 1,000 plants in the state. She says for a site to be truly clear of the weed, it has to go 8 years without any seeding plants. The project started working with the dogs 3 years ago. Birch says the dogs are good PR and that they pique people's curiosity and help get the word out about the project. And they catch what people miss.
Mainly in the Missoula site, the site's very steep, very brushy, lots of trees that you can have a woad on one side, and if you're walking on the other, you won't see it. And so the dogs have the ability to catch the scent and be able to identify those plants on the other side of the tree.
Good girl!
Lily has found a woad and immediately gets rewarded with her toy, a ball on a rope. Hertz says this toy reward is how they train the dogs.
Well, you know, if you're training a dog to go duck hunting, you use a breed of dog that has an instinctual interest in birds. And so obviously we don't have that. You know, there's no dog bred to care about weeds. So what we use are dogs that really, really, really like to play with their toy.
Hertz says they find a lot of their dogs at animal shelters. She says they've worked in 18 states and 10 countries.
A lot of what we find is animal scat, their droppings, because you can get DNA from that. So without ever having to see the animal or handle the animal, we can get genetic information from that.
Hertz says the scat can help show things like the population numbers and any disease in the population.
Sometimes we look for the animal itself, like a desert tortoise or an invasive snail in Hawaii that's eating the native snails. And then sometimes, like now, we're looking for plants. And the plants can be either rare threatened plants, Kincaid's lupin in Oregon, which is the host to an endangered butterfly.
Hertz says they've also traveled to Africa for the dogs to sniff out poachers' snares. All work towards conservation efforts.
Since in order to do conservation, you have to be able to find the invasive or the endangered animal. And as people, we only have our eyes to do that. You know, we can, when we work with dogs, we bring scent to the picture and their noses.
Hertz says the dogs will case an area after people have gone through and find what got overlooked. With invasive weeds, the dog tracks down the plant, people pull it, and then someone comes by to spray the area later.
Good girl!
Katherine Fry reporting from the Flathead.
One in 2,000 kids are born with genital or reproductive anatomy or chromosomal patterns that are not clearly male or female. This genetic intersex trait often sends parents into a panic and surgeons to reach for a scalpel to, quote, fix the problem. But that approach can lead to lifelong physical and emotional problems for the child. A Missoula couple, well-known singer Eden Atwood and her partner Jim Ambrose, have co-founded an organization known as the Interface Project to educate people about those born with the intersex trait and to remove the shame that often is associated with it. In tonight's feature interview, Ambrose and Atwood talk with news director Sally Mock about their personal experiences as people born with the trait and about their project.
So sometimes kids are diagnosed because right at birth, a doctor, a midwife, parents look at the genitals of a child and they say, boom, it's a boy, or boom, it's a girl. But sometimes, due to a genetic factor, a kiddo is born with genitals that do not confirm them easily as male or female. You know, the biggest thing about our work is that what happens to these kids that are born where their genitals do not immediately confirm them is that there's a great deal of fear and prejudice and shame that traditionally dealt with is that a pediatric urologist is called in and a scalpel is raised, and we wind up having a situation where these kids have their genitals, quote-unquote, normalized. And that's always to the female because you can't do it the other direction. But these surgeries, when you put a scalpel into perfectly healthy flesh, and by and large, there's no medical emergency here. It's a social emergency. When these kids have these surgeries, you put a scalpel into healthy flesh, you create scar tissue. And that scar tissue winds up lacking in sensation, sometimes resulting in pain.
Which can be lifelong.
Absolutely. And really, I think that the most important thing is that the minute you raise a scalpel to a kid and you say, hey, the way you were born is not good enough, or it's not going to cut it, or we're afraid of this, because very scared parents think, who's going to change the diaper? What are we going to do? How are we going to explain this? We need to do something ostensibly to protect the child from fear and prejudice and shame. It really winds up only doing that very thing. It instills shame. It instills greater fear and prejudice, and that's why people have not heard about intersex conditions.
And Jim, often this is done to children who have no say in this. No matter what their age, the surgery is done because the parents want it done.
The stretch is to get parents to conceive of their children as future sexual beings, as future autonomous adults. And in my experience with friends who have had kids, with my own parents, that's the last thing that parents want to think about on the day their kid is born.
Let's talk about your experience, Jim. You were born with this intersex trait.
Yeah, I was born with XY chromosomes and undescended testes and a phallus that was puzzling to my caregivers, my parents, my doctors. They didn't know if it was a very large clitoris or a very small penis. What happened to me was that they took out my reproductive organs. They cut off my internal testes, undescended testes, and they removed my penis, which is what it was then, what it would be now. And they raised me as a girl.
But you're now living as a man.
Right.
Eden, you also had this trait, but in a different situation. Was it chromosomal?
Jim and I share the same syndrome, but there is a complete form, quote-unquote, and a partial form. And so in my situation, I was born looking, and the word is phenotypically, totally female, and it was not discovered until I was not going through, you know, a typical puberty stage. I didn't start menstruating. All my other little girlfriends had. I was very concerned and confused. But my intersex story doesn't start until I'm 14 and living in Butte, Montana, and begging my mother to take me to the gynecologist or the pediatrician, where I understood that you could get, there was a miracle shot that would make you start your period. I mean, basically a powerful dose of estrogen. And we did that, and nothing happened. And what we, that's when the conversations, I had blood tests done, and then I was no longer included in the conversations that took place between my mother and my doctor. I was in the waiting room, not knowing what was going on, and then watching my mother come out, red-eyed, not able to look at me. And I don't think she was not able to look at me because she was ashamed of me necessarily. I think she was just terrified and didn't know what to do. So her thinking was, well, I'm going to take her to the very best place I can think of. So we got on a plane and went to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. And at the Mayo Clinic, this storied institution of medicine, I met with endocrinologists and had more blood drawn, and it was very quickly decided that I was going to have a surgery. And the surgery, I was told, was to take out my cancerous twisted ovaries, and that's all the information I ever got.
It wasn't true.
It was not true. It was not true. What was true, and what I learned in stages after that, was that I had XY, or typically male chromosomes. I had undescended testes that were pumping out large amounts of testosterone, and some of that naturally converts to estrogen through the aromatization process. So I had a little bit of secondary sex characteristic. I had a little breast development, but I was also very tall. And so this surgery happened, and they sent me home, and I got put on the Premarin regimen as well. Again, if you take out your hormone-producing organs, your reproductive organs, you have to replace that or you don't get the bone protection. And so osteoporosis is a very real consideration. What wound up coming to light for me is that while I looked entirely female, I had undescended testes. I had XY chromosomes. I would never have children biologically, and I was told that. But the idea that a little girl could have testes in place of ovaries was untenable. That was not okay. They inflate a, they, and I mean the medical profession, inflated at that time a cancer risk of having testes remain a child abdominally. Turns out that risk is actually very, very low. There was the understanding that she doesn't need to know. The doctors at the Mayo Clinic told my mother, we're not going to tell her. She doesn't need to know. We're only going to tell her cancerous twisted ovaries and you'll never have kids and you have to take these pills.
We should make the point that the physicians and the parents in this case are trying to do what they think is best for the child. It's just that, in your opinion, misguided approach, because really honesty would take away the shame.
Absolutely. I mean, the moment you decide to lie to a kid, it constitutes a real attachment disruption between parents and the child. There's a secret that the parents are now tasked with keeping. A secret is by definition a shameful state. So whether I knew that or not, I certainly felt that there was something incredibly shameful.
Jim, the Interface Project, what you and Eden hope it does is, first of all, remove the shame and also give people information so that they can make decisions that are best for them.
Our intention also is to reach out to caregivers, doctors, and families. I mean, intersex individuals will find some narratives on our website that will resonate with them and that will give them encouragement and make them feel supported.
The motto of our project is no body is shameful, and the Interface Project is modeled somewhat after Dan Savage's It Gets Better campaign, which is gay and lesbian celebrities speaking to youth saying, hey, coming out is difficult. Maybe you don't have a lot of support. Maybe being outside of the typical mainstream world is hard, but it does get better because you're able to find support and community, and we will effect some social change over time. I think that the one thing we don't advocate for third space gender or fourth or fifth or sixth. We say to parents, choose a gender, choose a name, and go forth, and know this. Don't ring a bell that cannot be unrung with a scalpel. Let your child tell you who they are because they know. They will know.
I've been speaking with Eden Atwood and Jim Ambrose, and they're co-founders of the Interface Project, bringing to light the trait of intersex. Wish you the best of luck with the project.
Thank you so much for being with us.
For more information, go to the website interfaceproject.org. Singers Eden Atwood and Huey Lewis are teaming up for a benefit concert for the Interface Project tomorrow night at 7:30 at the Missoula Children's Theater. Tickets are $100, with proceeds going to the project's effort to collect and share the stories of those born with the intersex trait.
In tonight's weather forecast for west of the Continental Divide, severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 p.m. for Missoula, Bitterroot Valleys, Bitterroot Sapphire Mountains, Butte Blackfoot region, and Potomac Sealy Lake region. Tonight calls for showers and thunderstorms. Some thunderstorms may produce gusty winds, large hail, and heavy rainfall. Lows will stay in the upper 40s to mid 50s. Tomorrow, rain showers and a slight chance of thunderstorms are likely. Highs will stay in the 60s. For central Montana, severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 p.m. For southern Rocky Mountain Front, Cascade, central and southern Lewis and Clark, Judith Basin, Fergus, and Marr. Tonight calls for isolated thunderstorms and rain showers. Some thunderstorms could be severe with damaging winds, large hail, and heavy rainfall. Lows will stick around 50 to 55 degrees. Tomorrow expect cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and isolated thunderstorms. Highs will peak around 60 to 70 degrees. And for southwest Montana, severe thunderstorm watch is in effect until 10 p.m. this evening for southwest Montana. Tonight we'll have rain showers and isolated thunderstorms are likely. Some thunderstorms may be severe with damaging winds, large hail, and heavy rainfall. Lows will be around 45 to 50 degrees. Tomorrow expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain showers and isolated thunderstorms. Highs will stay around 70 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Evan Barrett.
Hey, Today I want to chat with you a little bit about Detroit and conquering challenges. You see, the challenge in Detroit is twofold, financial and economic. There are sensible and proven solutions to both challenges. This country and its leadership need to move beyond dogma and politics and do the right thing for both Detroit and the nation. The first and most obvious challenge is financial. Obvious because more than 90% of the news coverage about Detroit focuses on the amount of its debt, the future obligations the city carries, and how impossible the situation looks to be for the long-term future. We all know the city has entered managed bankruptcy as a way to negotiate its way out of its long-term financial dilemma. We also know of this challenge because it fits the favored narrative of so many in the political arena and so much of the media, the narrative that financial disaster looms for all of us here in the U.S., even if that disaster narrative is as much fancy as it is fact. But as distasteful as it sounds, Detroit's bankruptcy does represent an opportunity to find solutions to some long-term challenges. The solutions will be tough to come by and often painful. But in the meantime, the city needs to be able to function to provide services to its citizens. Until Detroit gets through its bankruptcy, what can we and our government do to help the city sustain itself? We can provide Detroit a proven tool from the past, bridge financing. Federal government loans or loan guarantees to Detroit, issued under favorable conditions, will ensure that Detroit can continue to function. Radical, you say? Well, they said the same thing when New York City was in a major financial crisis. But in 1975, President Ford, incidentally a Republican, signed the New York City Seasonal Financing Act, which released $2.3 billion in loans to the city. Over the next decade, until 1986, New York City accessed about $10 billion in today's dollars in loan guarantees and direct loans from the people of the United States through our government. And it worked. All of those funds have since been repaid. So while Detroit's bankruptcy process continues and long-term solutions are sought, we have it within our power to ensure the short-term viability of one of America's major cities through a proven tool. The second challenge for Detroit, one that gets less coverage, is economic. And keep in mind that the ultimate solution to all the financial woes of Detroit and other struggling cities is a vibrant economy. But currently, unemployment in Detroit is officially over 16%. Underemployment in Detroit in 2011 was estimated to be 50%. The economy in Detroit, despite the recent gains of the auto industry, which, by the way, were helped by federal funds, that economy is in shambles. Money is not being spent on the streets and in the neighborhoods of Detroit. An economic death spiral has begun, a spiral that is almost impossible to reverse without a lot of money hitting the streets of Detroit. At the same time, Detroit's infrastructure, like much of the rest of the nation, is falling into further disrepair, and more than 30,000 Detroit houses are abandoned and deteriorating. In Detroit, then, there is a nexus of people needing jobs, paychecks, education, and retraining, with infrastructure that needs repair or replacement, and housing that needs to be demolished or rehabilitated. That nexus provides an opportunity to infuse capital into Detroit to help sustain and grow the struggling economy now and begin long-term economic restructuring over time. With that opportunity facing us, Detroit should become the epicenter of a Marshall Plan for America's cities. Rebuild our cities with our workers. In the case of Detroit, educated, retrained, and available from within. Rebuild our cities with our workers using our money, which for the last decade has been frittered away by the trillions in the Middle East on military misadventures brought to you by the oil industrial political complex. A peace dividend of funds from ending or seriously reducing military spending in the Middle East can be used for the new American Marshall Plan, for which Detroit would be the initial poster child. Would that increased spending in Detroit help its economy and people? The evidence is indisputably yes. Economic activity and growth coming from government spending is a proven method, notwithstanding the current chorus of austerity whiners. They are wrong, and the Keynesian economists are right. Despite the political rhetoric of the whiners, the demonized stimulus of 2009 and 2010 demonstrably helped pull the U.S. economy from the economic brink. The flip side is demonstrated as well. Cutting government spending hurts the economy and costs jobs. The Congressional Budget Office recently estimated that the reduced spending in the sequester will cost us up to 1.6 million less jobs by the end of next year. So, we as a nation can and should invest in ourselves as we have in the past, with Detroit being the model. This is Evan Barrett in Butte, thinking about American solutions for American cities.
Evan Barrett is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Sarah Jovetich.
And I'm Courtney Anderson. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.